providing unique reporting on markets and companies since 1990. This is the Cortland Economics Report.
All right, welcome back. Continuing to listen to the weekend edition of the KE Report. And as promised in the back two segments here, we are going to focus a little bit more on the resource space, especially when it comes to the underlying stocks, as we are chatting with Matt Geiger, managing partner at MJG Capital. Now, Matt, before we get into a focus on the resource sector, I do want to talk about the broader markets here because, look, it has been an impressive rally. This whole year, the markets have done fairly well, but it's just been in the last couple months when markets bottomed kind of at the tail end of October and have moved pretty much straight up. We have the Dow at all-time highs. The S&P is very close to all-time highs. I guess a lot of this is on the back of this whole pivot party from the Fed and locking in, or at least saying that they will be cutting rates next year, even if things seem to be going pretty well. But overall, investors seem to have rotated money out of money market funds into broad equities. Matt, what do you take away from this environment?
Well, it's good to be with you, Corey. And man, I agree with you. It's been a wild 6 weeks in particular since right at the tail end of October, the S&P is now up over 15% over that period. And it may not seem this way to so many of the, you know, long-only listeners that may be listening to this podcast, but I'm viewing this actually as a classic Max Payne event. And who's feeling the pain? Institutions primarily, those that are either market neutral or net short the market. Definitely some short squeeze activity going on here. And then additionally, mom and pop investors, many of which are still heavy in terms of cash, dating all the way back to the COVID shakeout in 2020. So I'd say that giant sucking sound that you hear is retail investors throwing the rest of their dry powder into equities, really in FOMO fashion. And these FOMO moves, while they can you know, continue with some duration, rarely end well. So I'm quite dubious by the extent of this move. Of course, Powell's comments were far more dovish than many expected. But if you looked at expectations, both the Fed's dot plot and just expectations amongst the market generally, folks were already expecting rate cuts next year. Maybe Powell was a bit more direct in affirming that view. You know, it's always worthy hearing it from the horse's mouth. But I personally am quite surprised by the extent of the reaction that we saw on the back of the last Fed meeting. I mean, this does beg the question, is now a good time to be piling into the U.S. Indices in particular? And I mean, the answer is a resounding no, as far as I'm concerned, at least for those that aren't short-term momentum traders. And there's a few factors to consider. First, the U.S. market, just looking at the U.S. market itself historically on absolute terms, the Buffett indicator is one thing to look at, which is the U.S. GDP relative to the combined capitalization of all U.S. Listed equities. And we are just below all-time highs. I will concede we're a little bit below where we were in November of 2021, but just below all-time highs and way above the peak seen before the dot-com bust or the great financial crisis in 2008. So we're certainly not cheap relative to where the U.S. market has been historically. We're also not cheap relative to other asset classes. Just look at the U.S. stock markets relative to global indices, or an even more extreme disparity is the U.S. stock market relative to emerging equities. So those that truly feel an urge to be deploying into equities right now, there are far better places to be looking, in my opinion, than the broader U.S. markets. And finally, just look at historical price behavior of U.S. markets when it comes to a Fed hike cycle. Historically, what we'll see, it's not the first hike that causes a major crash, nor is it the pause. It's actually the first cut. And this has occurred time and time again. So it's quite possible that it's different this time. There are no guarantees. History does not always repeat. But what we're seeing here appears to mirror pretty classic behavior of past cycles, where the market actually rallies very strongly into the pause. And then the pain occurs when we first see the cut.
Yeah, man, I think that's such a key point because a lot of people thought it was the hiking that was going to be the problem. But it's actually when you start cutting, because it means that the Fed is seeing something under the surface where there could be economic weakness. And In all reality, that's what they wanted to see. And they are getting that in the real estate market and manufacturing and other sectors. But when we do start seeing the cuts or just the market anticipating them and hearing it, as you say, from the horse's mouth, it has given all markets a big rally. It wasn't just the general markets. We've seen that in the cryptocurrencies. We've seen that in commodities. We've definitely seen that in precious metals. We saw gold do an about face from pulling back for all of last week to rocketing back higher again this week. What do you make of the disconnect, though, that we still see in the junior mining sector? While most of the metals and commodities are running, and that's on a weak dollar and rates continuing to pull back, we just noted before this call that the 10-year has already pulled back down below 4% again. We haven't seen that in a while. That is helping the underlying metals, but it's not really moving the mining stocks as much. What's your lay of the land on the junior resource sector?
Well, in the short term, I'm actually very bullish. I mean, I think it's clear that the animal spirits are out more generally in financial markets. And I would not be surprised at all to see a very strong rally into the new year here. And I think this rally could continue as long as broader financial markets remain buoyant. Now, my concern remains that the juniors will get whacked, as they always do, without fail, whenever the broader financial markets next roll over. And that will occur. My expectation is it will occur next year. Perhaps it will be longer than that. Perhaps it will be just a few months from now. But we will see another period of financial pain. And when that occurs, the juniors will get whacked. In that period in between, however, I think there's a ton of catching up to do. Because as we discussed on our last call, I actually was expecting quite a bit of weakness in the junior patch this year. But with the expectations that the broader market would be the driver of that pain. What I certainly did not foresee was the juniors getting whacked to the extent that they did, while broader financial markets, broader equity markets continue to march towards all-time highs, especially as we're seeing in the United States. So I do foresee an explosive rally, some catching up, so to speak. I mean, we're right at the tail end of tax loss season here. And I think that can continue until we see the next major market dislocation. Think the COVID 2020 panic, or even the period in Q2 and Q3 of last year when the Fed hike cycle began. So I've actually gotten quite a bit more aggressive than I anticipated. Just in September we were in double digit cash positions. We're now in the low single digits. Of course, if this rally does materialize, then I will look to increase our cash to a more conservative posture. With the expectation that there will be pain when the broader markets roll over.
Matt, what about the major stocks, though? Because look at how much Newmont has moved. We're recording this about halfway through the day on Thursday, and just if you take into account the moves on Wednesday and now half of Thursday, Newmont's up almost 10% on high volume, too. How much will the juniors benefit from, who knows? This could be a significant uptrend in the majors.
Right. Well, I mean, if this is a significant uptrend in the majors, then we will see the trickle down effect occur. That's how the strongest moves generally materialize. You need a few ingredients. You need intense pain and absolutely bombed out sentiment. And that's certainly what we saw in September, October, November period. And then you need the larger, more liquid names to lead. And if that continues for a sustainable period of time, and animal spirits remain high, you do see the trickle down into the juniors. And that's when you can see those explosive moves really materialize.
Well, Matt, we've also seen on the recent uplift in metals prices and a little bit of action in the majors and a little bit of action in the sector, a string of private equity and even royalty and streaming deals pop up. The capital markets are opening back up. What do you make of that?
Yeah, I found this interesting. I mean, I wouldn't say some parts of the capital markets have opened up. I mean, I view this as private equity and the royalty and streamers really stepping in here to fill the gap left by extremely depressed equity markets within the mining space. We've had a few deals of note here just in the past 5 or 6 trading days. The first one was Gold Royalty investing $31 million into Aura Minerals' Borborema project down in Brazil, to comprise a part of the project's construction financing package. The money, however, interestingly here, is really not from Gold Royalty. I mean, they're technically the ones that are sending the wires over to Aura Minerals, but Gold Royalty did not have this money on their balance sheet. Concurrent with that deal being announced, Aura announced a deal with Queens Road Capital and Australian private equity group Taurus Funds Management, where those two put $40 million into Gold Royalty in the form of convertible debt to allow them to make this transaction. So this is really money flowing from private equity to Aura Minerals with Gold Royalty serving as an intermediary. More recently this week, we saw Orion put $80 million into Solaris Resources, presumably to get their Warintza project in Ecuador to a construction decision, or at least close to a construction decision. And this is a case of Orion doing what they do best. They've always been comfortable offering multiple financing options, and that could be a royalty and stream, that could be an offtake agreement, that could be a senior debt arrangement, could be convertible debt, it could be equity. Well, most groups out there just hone in on one of these. So they're able to offer a suite of financing options, you know, from one group. I mean, in this case, it was $60 million in senior debt, I believe, and $10 million in equity, and then a $10 million offtake agreement as well. And then just this morning, we're talking on Thursday, December 14th, Vista Gold announced a deal with Wheaton for its Mount Todd project, where Wheaton's providing $20 million U.S. to Vista Gold in exchange for a 1% gross revenue royalty over their project. And interestingly, as has been the case with many of Wheaton's deals in the past 9 or 12 months, this deal comes with a ROFR over any additional streams, royalties, or prepays that Vista applies to Mount Todd in the future. And Wheaton really seems to value ROFRs far more than its royalty peers and competitors. And they've even shown a willingness in recent months to stray from their to stray from the royalty and streaming model and do direct equity investments into companies. A couple examples are Liberty Gold and Integra as well. And in each case, they made this equity investment, but my sense was that the real investment or the real draw of the investment from Wheaton's perspective was getting a ROFR in each of these cases for future royalties or streams over the given project. So that's something to note, and I don't see any other major royalty company out there really putting this focus on ROFRs. And I just say more generally, I think these deals actually serve as a bit of a contrarian indicator. You know, as I see it, the smart money clearly thinks that it's a good time to deploy, as the cost of capital for equity is just so high at the moment. And I think we could see a flurry of, you know, similar deals with private equity and or royalty and streaming groups into the new year, unless, of course, juniors rally so sharply that the deal window slams, you know, shut in the face of these royalty and streaming and PE groups. But I think we do still see a few more maybe over the coming 30 to 60 days.
Well, we all know that if the markets keep going, if these stock prices keep going, money really frees up for these companies. But Matt, talking about these private equity deals, these royalty and streaming deals, they really are stepping stones for some of these companies to hopefully get these well-established assets built. Do you think we will see more of these projects actually go into construction next year or even in the next couple of years?
Yeah, I mean, it's really project dependent and also commodity dependent. I mean, for the three that we discussed, I mean, Warintza is still a couple years before they can even get to the point where they could potentially press go. Aura Minerals, Borborema project, that is a go. So I do think we'll see first production there. Mount Todd is a beast of a project. So $20 million is just a drop in the bucket for what they need to actually build that thing. So in the case of these specifics, we'll see. Yeah, more generally, you really have to look at the price incentives. Like for copper, for instance, we're trading around $3.60, $3.70 a pound. To really see the big boys press go on the next wave of major new copper mines, we're going to need to see 525, 550 copper, if not quite a bit higher. I think it's well understood, well agreed upon within the industry that 525 range is where the incentive price is. But in past cycles, we've seen the actual spot price of the metals need to go up sometimes close to twice the incentive price before the big boys really get a move on. So I think particularly in the copper space, we need to see some significant price moves before we see, you know, the next generation of mines really get rolling.
Well, Matt, just on this topic of strategic investments or different funds coming in the royalty space, we did see one other one of note, and it was with Star Royalties announcing that Synovus Energy has taken a stake in the Green Star Royalties, which is a JV with themselves and Agnico Eagle. So this is on the carbon credit side of the royalty space. First of all, that's unique, just the royalties on carbon credits, but also it shows more money coming into the royalty sector. What do you make of that deal?
Yeah, well, I'm quite close to that deal. You know, for full disclosure, Star Royalties is our is one of our larger holdings within the fund, and we've been buying in the aftermath of that deal. Look, I mean, it's quite exciting from my perspective. Synovus, for those that don't know, is a $30 billion oil and gas company headquartered out of Calgary, and they cut a $21 million check to Star Royalties Green Star subsidiary. Green Star's focused specifically on carbon credit royalty and stream deals. So upon this investment, Synovus now joins Agnico Eagle as the second major strategic to have put money into Green Star. Agnico came in spring of 2022, and so it took a good 18 months for Green Star to find its next major strategic investor. But Synovus is coming in at a 50% premium to Agnico's initial investment, which I think caught quite a few folks by surprise, particularly given how poorly and carbon markets have performed over the past couple of years. So each of these companies now own, both Agnico and Synovus now own just under 26% of Green Star, with Star Royalties owning the rest, around 46%. The post-money valuation of Synovus's investment was around $82 million. So Star Royalties' stake in Green Star is equivalent to 50 cents per Star share. This, of course, assumes that Synovus paid a fair price. So there's still a pretty significant disconnect between Star's current trading price and where Synovus priced Green Star with this most recent financing. I mean, more generally, this does beg the question, you know, whether this deal could mark the bottom or at least some green shoots. It is what has been an absolutely abysmal 2 years for anybody involved in the carbon credit space. I would say the jury is still out, but I know for sure that many of Green Star's peers were actually thrilled to see this deal announced, you know, even though Green Star is technically one of their competitors. But the financing window for a lot of these carbon credit and royalty groups that, you know, seem to be spawning every month in 2021 has absolutely slammed shut. So these groups have largely been spinning their wheels for 2 years. They have a name, they have a company, most of them private, but they don't have any money to deploy. And I know one of the more credible competitors of Green Star, private competitors of Green Star, got close to closing a financing this past summer, but the deal fell apart at the 11th hour, just given how poorly carbon markets have performed over the past 18 to 24 months. So, you know, it's, again, jury's still out, but I think this could be a sign that, at least for the more credible carbon royalty and streaming operators, we could see some more capital coming in. And of course, from Green Star's perspective, I mean, this is an excellent countercyclical opportunity. You know, they now have $20 million to deploy into, you know, various options. I know they have a full deal pipeline solely focused on North America. And I expect they'll be pretty active here as most of their competitors just don't have the balance sheets to go out and do additional deals at the moment.
Yeah, well, as you said, a lot of these companies were celebrating the deal because it is a deal that is actually happening in the carbon market after all these companies were announced just over the last couple of years. But Matt, how do you even go about analyzing some of these carbon companies? They're so new and the market is, it's out there, but the pricing model is confusing. All these companies, it's confusing to know what even assets they have. How do you go about even selecting a carbon company that you're getting into?
It is. And I know there's a lot of skepticism about the carbon credit space, and there should be. I mean, it is truly the Wild West out there. I think one point that's worth clarifying, and CEO of Star Royalties, Alex Pernin, you know, explains this well. It's best to think of the carbon credit market as one would think of the diamond market. There is technically an index called the CBL Nature-Based Global Emission Offset Index that tries to track carbon credit prices. And that indice, interestingly, is off an astounding 95%. From early 2022. It reached up close to $19 per credit. It's now sub a dollar per credit. But it's important to note, these are very low quality credits. These are kind of commoditized credits without really the ability to back. So that's not the way to look at the space. The credits that Star and the more credible groups are looking at literally are trading at 20 to 30x premiums to the credits that you see within the CBL nature-based index. So it's extremely important to know the project, know the operators, know the different counterparties, and there's just a massive spread between the value of individual credits, just as one would see within the diamond space. So I think part of the reason there's this perception of the carbon credit market absolutely being bombed out is this actual index, which is really the only index that you can follow. But that's actually, for the higher quality credits, prices have actually hung in there pretty well. So from STAR's perspective, it's less that they're able to, you know, participate in distressed deals. It's more that just the competition for these higher quality credits is very low at the moment. So that's the excitement from their perspective. And I would just say, look, to the folks that are skeptical on the space, again, skepticism is warranted, but look at the strategics, look at Agnico Eagle, look at this oil and gas company, Cenovus, you know, putting their money where their mouth is. You know, whether or not you even agree that global warming is a valid concern to be had, there is going to be tremendous demand for these credits going forward. And that's both from, you know, regulatory compliance markets, with governments potentially forcing carbon credit, you know, requirements on companies. I know there's some contention about that, but it'll also be in the voluntary market, you know, companies going out of their way to purchase credits so that they can then tell their customers and consumers that they're a net neutral company. And I know some folks would say, well, that's just greenwashing and that, that shouldn't be taken at face value. And maybe that's the case, but it's still happening either way. So I think we're still in the very early stages of this market. I hope that the past 2 years has served as a bit of a culling period, both for the new entrants that we saw come in and during the hype days of 2021, and also in terms of lower quality projects that are out there. But I do believe that those that are able to survive this period are in actually very good position over the coming years. So this is our only, you know, carbon credit focused investment. STAR, of course, also comes with a mining royalty component as well that I would argue is, you know, worth between 20 to 30 cents per share on its own right. But from my perspective, you know, STAR is through and through a carbon credit focused investment with a nice little mining kicker, which is receiving no value at the moment.
All right, Matt, we'll wrap it up here. Man, oh man, I find this coal carbon sector so interesting because there are so many companies that have gotten behind it, so many groups have gotten behind it. But as you said, kind of the wild, wild west, but any sort of big investments, that's huge. And hey, government policies, that could really be a driver behind some of these. And just larger companies taking a more proactive role to, who knows, buy these companies, buy carbon credits, who knows how it's all going to play out.
That's right. Whether you agree with it or not, it's happening.
Exactly. Well, Matt, thank you very much for your time on this weekend show. It's a great chatting with you on a pretty much monthly basis now. And remember, you can keep up to date with Matt over at the MJG Capital website, which we will link to within the weekend show posting. And everybody, thanks for tuning in on this weekend show. We hope you all have a great rest of your weekend. We will be back with some editorials throughout the week right before Christmas. So please keep up to date with us on our website, kereport.com, and podcast, The KE Report. Matt, everyone listening, again, thanks for your time this weekend. Hope you all have a great rest of your weekend.